everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Wake podcast, a festive special, although there's a bit less of a good cheer this season around SC25, with Palace coming to two back-to-back defeats, home and away, against Arsenal in the Cup and League, respectively. And joining me for this last festive special before the Christmas break, Bobby Manzi of The New Shopper and a friend of the pod. Bobby, how are you doing, mate?
Last festive special before the break. We've already had a festive special, have we?
That's if you got me there. All right, it's my words. Keeping it. Fuck
it. No, I'm very well, thank you. Rough couple of days on the Palace front, but personally, well myself. Not going down to Bournemouth on Boxing Day, so that's a relief. Less travelling for me to do. Covering the game from home. No more press conferences now until before Southampton. So yeah, can wind down a little bit and enjoy the Christmas break.
Oh, good, lovely stuff. I mean, I'm good for my end. I'm actually in the Cotswolds at the moment with family, so I'm not beating those posh allegations anytime soon.
Very, very, very fancy.
I know. It's just, is it not remarkably on brand?
I'm meant to be away in the Cotswolds of the weekend of, is the fourth round of the FA Cup. So, but if obviously Palace get through, then I'll be doing Palace.
Oh, good stuff. I've not been on the pod for a while, have I? I'm covering for Bruno and Pat, for those listening, which is generally how we do it now. I'm more of the backup. So for those that listened last season and missed me, which is, I'm imagining, very few people, that's the way it is at the Palace way. But no,
We're the B team.
Sorry, go on.
We're the B team. We're like Arsenal on Wednesday night.
Yeah. No, we are the B team, actually. Hopefully not B Tech in what we're saying, though. Yeah, I just wanted to say about the Cup, because I didn't get the chances to say it, obviously, in previous episodes. I actually go to county games sometimes, because they're, you know, a proper working-class club from an area of Manchester very easy for me to get to. So I had to get the whole Manchester thing in early, of course. But no, in all seriousness, I thought, for me personally, a very good draw, but one that obviously Palace should be getting through. Good team, really good fans, playing a really good system of football as well, with a manager that I think is rising stock in the EFL. So just a little bit on that. But we will go on to the main event, Bobby.
Just on the Cup, really quickly, because obviously I don't think it's something we get a lot of time to talk about. But Stockport have been okay in League One, and there'll be a tough test for Palace, but I think it's going to be a lot easier now. Louis Barry's been called back from Aston Villa today, and he obviously won't be available for the Cup game, because he's a top talent, a really good finisher, really good striker. And it's certainly one less thing for Palace to worry about in January.
No, definitely, definitely. I mean, obviously, I've been following his rise somewhat closely too. And I mean, he's incredibly prolific at both League Two and League One level in his time at Stockport. So,
yeah, I think they'll almost try and put him into the Championship in January at Villa. He's been superb at Stockport. And I say it's no surprise he's been recorded. I think, what is he? Has he scored something like 24 goals this season, or since he's been at Stockport? Is it 24 goals in like 40?
At Stockport, definitely, but he's comfortably hitting double figures. He looks far too good for League One level. You know, this is a kid who was at Barcelona at one point, albeit briefly. I mean, that's a bit of a streets won't forget weird transfer, but nonetheless, it shows that the sort of ability that he has and could go on to have in the future. So I totally understand why they've done that. So hopefully that dampens their front line a bit. Anyway, well, this isn't a Stockport pod. Without further ado, the main event. No one wants to listen to an hour-long pod about two defeats. We're going to be completely honest. So we'll keep it brief, keep it thematic, and keep it fresh. But let's talk about the Cup run, first of all. Obviously beating the likes of Norwich, QPR and Villa in some very convincing performances, with some of the fringe players that perhaps get a little bit more stick from Palace fans getting on the score sheet, doing well. Obviously coming to an abrupt end in a 3-2 defeat, giving the gingerbread man himself, Gabriel Jesus, his hat-trick and giving him a resurgence in form. So aside from the Charity FC allegations, Bobby, what did you pick out from the game overall, first and foremost?
Yeah, I thought it was meant to be Christmas, to be honest, not Easter, because magically Jesus come back to life. But no, it was... The Arsenal game was a weird one for me, the first Arsenal game, that is. I thought in the first half, Palace did okay. But if they were going to win that game of football, they had to find a second goal. I said it in a tweet. Because Arsenal were always going to make those changes at half-time. They were always going to go for the game. And a one-goal lead against Arsenal, when they're bringing on the likes of Odegaard, Gabriel, Saliba, etc., is never going to be enough. And the game proved to go exactly that way, really. I thought in the second half, Palace just weren't good enough, frankly. Arsenal moved the ball far too quickly. It was like watching Brazil of the 80s and the 90s. It was just, they played some really good, incisive football. And Palace were no match for him, really, and I think it was the right result. Obviously, a little bit of frustration with the offside goal for them to go 2-1 up, but you're going to get those decisions when there's no VAR in a game, and you just have to take those. I thought the referee was shambolic. I thought every little niggly challenge went Arsenal's way. I don't think Palace got anywhere near as much of the fouls that Arsenal got and when they should have had them, because they both teams were doing the exact same thing. But yeah, on the whole, I thought it was a fair result. I think it was probably a comprehensive beating in that second half, even though Eddie Nketiah come on and took his goal superbly. And yeah, I think it's one of those ones where you're like, oh, what could have been if maybe you didn't play Arsenal or if they went for a bit more in the first half. But at the end of the day, the right team won.
No, definitely. I think anything other than an Arsenal win would have been a smash and grab. And coincidentally, my flatmate is a massive Arsenal fan, family originally from North London, but he's half Greek Cypriot. And I said the exact same thing to him. You know, I had to give my hand to him and just say, look, we were second best. It felt that way, start to finish, in terms of momentum. One, I don't like to dig out people, other pods, anything like that. But I do want to give some criticism, particularly to AFTV for tweeting about, you know, no VAR, no problem, and words to that effect, because among other prominent Arsenal voices, they've been crying corruption and every little issue all season. They've been moany little bitches all season, and I'll go on record as saying that. And to actually then pick out the issue and make light of it when it goes their way, I think is absolutely disgraceful. So don't get me wrong, offside goal, we should take some comfort in that. But I think this is a serious issue in football that needs to be talked about. And I think those that criticise VAR for all its faults need to really check their slow memories, I think, because this was something that was a regular occurrence in the Premier League. So I'm not going to moan about being hard done by, you know, we're man enough to accept that, I think, on this pod, and we do. So we go again. But I really want to make that point, because it's astounding to me that this is an issue that gets almost laughed about in hindsight by Arsenal fans. So
do you not think Alan Smith was the bigger issue? I was at the game, but I heard the commentary back afterwards. You can't have an ex-pro on commentary when the league commentator says that looks offside, going, we don't care. I mean, frankly, you're either offside or you're not. Now, it's not going to be given, so it doesn't matter in that respect, but it's still something that should be talked about. He was a whole man offside. It was quite obvious when you see the replay. But I get the liner's going to get things wrong there. Human error, etc. That's fine. I can tolerate that. But I just thought his attitude on comms wasn't acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we all grew up playing FIFA with him on it. He's a legendary commentator, but you expect better standards from someone in terms of professionalism when they're employed by Sky and going on that. So, you know, I don't want to be whiny myself, ironically, and go to labour the point too much, because like I say, I fully accept that, you know, that's the risk you sign up for when you play in a competition without VAR. You know, we have to take it on the chin and move on. But speaking of moving on, one big positive from that game was essentially an unchanged lineup except one. Obviously, we talked briefly before the game about who could possibly be coming into that side on socials, and it was a much speculated item on the agenda. It ended up going to the perhaps braver option, which I think was incredibly brave from Oliver Glasner, and we started academy product Caleb Cupora over a depth option such as perhaps Richards or Klein, particularly the latter being probably most likely. So what did you think of the decision to play it? I mean, to play devil's advocate, I know we want kids being played, which is a big joke that people mention about this pod, by the way, which we quite like. But do you not think it's kind of irresponsible to throw someone in with such little experience in a game like that on that occasion?
No, I'm not going to sit here and act like I thought it was the wrong decision, because I was the man on the podcast previewing the Arsenal game saying it had to be Cupora who played there. Nathaniel Klein's not a wing-back. Joel Ward's a centre-back. Cupora's a wing-back. So if you look at who suits the system, it was Caleb Cupora. Now, did he have a good game against Arsenal? Not really. The first 20 minutes he struggled. I think Glasner said in his press conference, it was words to the effect of that he was dazed by the occasion. And I think that's fair. And then he grew into it, which I also buy. But he could have been sent off. He wasn't the brightest of performances from him, but he's an 18-year-old kid. He's going to learn. And he's going to develop. But for one, there's not for one minute I can suggest that it was the wrong decision to play him, because profile of players wise, he was the one player that made sense to come into the system to try and offset the loss of Daniel Munoz. It might not have worked, but it doesn't mean it was the wrong decision.
No, definitely. I mean, there is a separate side to that coin, which is how integral Daniel Munoz is to that system. Before I look at Cupora for the league game at home, how have you found Daniel Munoz's absence? By the way, he's been enjoying a lovely holiday in Lapland, so probably well-deserved, all things considered, because he's worked so hard for this team. But what do you make of Daniel Munoz's absence? How important is he to the way that we play?
Now, I don't actually know when Daniel Munoz went to Lapland, because I was at the training ground the day he posted that photo, and I'd literally seen him like 5 hours before he posted that. So whether he'd already been and he was just posting it, or who knows, but whatever. So yeah, the point of what you're making, Daniel Munoz, I'm actually working on a piece on this at the moment, hopefully to go out tomorrow. Need to give it a couple more bits of thought before posting it, get edited, whatever. But anyway, that's besides the point. I think the two games that he's missed has probably highlighted how important he is to the Palace side. I think offensively and defensively, he's superb attacking outlet, non-stop work rate, a dog-eat-dog defender. And he's just the perfect wing back for Oliver Glasner's system. And then when you took that away, obviously you missed an attacking threat on the right-hand side, but I also think it exacerbated even more how weak Tyrick Mitchell probably is on the left. There was just no creative threat in wide areas from Palace. They were vulnerable to Arsenal's wing play, which is superb anyway. We all know how good Martinelli is on his day. We all know how good Saka is on his day. We all know how good Leandro Trossard is on his day. And I just think, yeah, it just underpins how important Daniel Munoz is to Crystal Palace, absolutely.
Yeah, it's amazing it's taken him this long to get two goals for the club, to be honest. I think the way he's been threatening has been phenomenal. Tyrick Mitchell, and by the way, I'm working on a piece. I've no idea when it'll be complete, which you know, Bobby, because we talked about it. But I found interesting that Tyrick Mitchell's shot creating actions per 90 this season in the league are incredibly similar to Milos Kerkez and even better than Ryan Aitnour is. So I think there is something to be said that Mitchell does have an improving attacking threat, but you know, he's definitely got work to be done in the
It's improving, but it's not good enough. And I think that's the point. Going forward, I'm never convinced by him. I think he's afraid to take players on at times. Yes, that cross against Brighton was exceptional, but 9 times out of 10 he gets the cross wrong. And this sounds like I'm coming down really harsh on him, and I probably am in a sense. But I think it's look. This is what he comes to, and I've taken a while to get to this point. But if Palace played a back four, Tyrick Mitchell would be one of the first names on the team sheet because he is an exceptional one-on-one defender. He is not an exceptional attacker, and I think sometimes people struggle to come to terms with this because he's come through the academy. He's a London boy. Everyone wants him to do well, and even I want him to do well. It's not that I don't want him to do well, but he just hasn't got that final cutting edge bit of end product. And ultimately, I think Palace need to sign a left wing back to provide that, because you can't get away in Oliver Glasner's system with having a left wing back who doesn't create enough chances.
No,
And just 3 weeks ago, I compiled some numbers, which I didn't publish, but I just did it for my own interest. And goal contributions per 90, Tyrick Mitchell was coming out as one of the bottom five to ever play in a Glasner system. And I don't think it works. And I think there's something to be said about having a Tyrick Mitchell in your squad and an attacking left wing back, and you can pick and choose what games they play. And then you've got options there. But I just don't think I don't think Tyrick Mitchell is good enough going forward to provide the threat he needs to.
Definitely. And I think one thing we can agree on this pod is that, you know, wing backs are make or break for the way we play under Glasner. When they have a good game, the whole team generally seems to. You know, it's so pivotal to how we play. So, you know, hopefully we can get a bit more reinforcement in January, which is something that we'll park for the next episode because we're leaving transfer chat for then. But I'm sure fans will have seen the links with Jan-Nicolas Best, formerly of Heidenheim, of course, now at Benfica. So we'll cover that in more detail in the next episode, but definitely something we should be looking at. Just to run it back a bit, because I wanted to just wrap up a bit about the wing backs. Caleb Cabora, we obviously just discussed, is having a sort of hit and miss game. I think for every mistake he made, it felt like he also had a good moment too, but nonetheless, probably a little bit out of his depth for that occasion. How did you feel he did specifically in the league game as well when he came on?
Did okay. Nothing special. It's hard coming on at the situation he came on in. I'm really cautious to either overly praise him or criticize him, because ultimately it's like 45 minutes against Arsenal in one game, and what was it in the second 20 minutes, if that. So it's really hard to give a comprehensive assessment when you're playing one of the best teams in the country. I've just not seen enough of him in senior football to come up with any fair judgment.
It looks like on what Glasner actually said in terms of when the question was asked. I can't. Did you ask him the question about being loaned out or not, Kapora? I can't actually remember.
Yeah, I
I thought it
did.
was. So, in that case, rather than me telling you what you already know, just for listeners' benefit, could you explain what Glasner's response was and then what you made of those comments?
So I spoke to some people, tried to kind of ascertain what the situation was. been having these conversations for a while, trying to work out what the deal is with Caleb, because he'd been in and among the squad and not really received many minutes. So I was thinking that maybe a loan would probably suit him, as it would someone like Asher in January. But then, yeah, it became pretty clear that that's not really something in Palace's thoughts. Obviously, you've seen Glasner's quotes. If you haven't, it was words to the effect, we'd rather him stay here, develop with the first team, learn our system, learn the way we play, learn our players, and learn from being in this environment. And he will get his minutes. If he doesn't get his minutes, then there'll be a conversation to have alone. But at the moment, I think he'll get his minutes. And then I spoke to a couple of people after that who echoed that sentiment from Glasner, but also went a bit deeper to explain a bit more. And apparently, from what I could gather, is that a loan has never been on the table this season for Kapora. It's not been something they considered at all, because of the fact they only have Klein and Ward who could possibly even cover for Munoz. Now, they don't think Ward's capable of doing that. Kleine too, bit shaky, but started the league game. So yeah, they see Kapora as an integral part of the squad, and yeah, expect him to stay with the side for the rest of the season.
Now, it's interesting insight there. Obviously, I don't personally feel he ever disgraced himself in either performance. I'm not saying he looked out of his, you know, in comfortable depth. I don't think he looked perfect, but he definitely didn't disgrace himself, and you can see the potential there. But he is only 18, and I think people realise that he's only really just jumped up to senior football at a tender age, and even going through the ranks of the under-21s felt like a step up that he took well. So that has to be credit where it's due.
It's also quite the birth of fire to have your two real substantial minutes that you've had as a senior footballer both to come against Arsenal. I mean, it's not an easy task. I also think you have to look at maybe what the future holds. And you're thinking maybe both Nathaniel Klein and Joel Walker get released next summer. So Kapora will continue to be an integral part of the Palace squad, unless they really sign two or three wingbacks, which I don't see happening. I think they might get one left wing back and one right wing back, but I don't see them signing real depth there. So yeah, I expect Caleb Kapora to be a big part in the next few years under Glasner.
Definitely. There's an opportunity cost in not signing someone or signing someone, and you don't want to block pathways. I know that's a very pro-Parish thing to say, but I think there is a genuine point there in that we have this potential coming through. There is no benefit to squandering it or not giving it the minutes it deserves to flourish. You know, there is a cost involved in replacing that. And if we can do it for our academy instead, that is of benefit to the club in the medium term and perhaps even the long term if we sell. I'll move on from the wing-back situation and just speak a little bit briefly about Eddie Nketiah. I mean, Mateta's goal was fantastic, as we know. I think we don't need to labour that point. But Nketiah is someone that has struggled for confidence more than anything else, I think. And to get a goal with aplomb in the way he did, taking in a fantastic looping header to bring some life back into that cup game, will do him a world of good in terms of his confidence. And I want to just get your thoughts overall, not just on the game and the goal, but also what he needs to do to improve in more detail. What does Eddie miss other than confidence? And do you think he's showing signs that he's getting there? What do you make of his overall game at the moment?
Yeah, he took the chance really well, actually. I was impressed. I was quite shocked, actually. It was more reminiscent of the Eddie Nketiah that had been seen in the past at Arsenal, where he did show his finishing ability. As for what's going wrong there, I think it's something that's gone wrong for a lot of players this season. It's a word we use a lot, and it's confidence, as you said. I think he really low on confidence. If I'm right in thinking, he didn't have the best goal-scoring form in his last real run of games at Arsenal. So yeah, a player low on confidence, a player trying to find himself, a player trying to prove himself as well. Hit with a couple of injuries when he joined Palace. So yeah, it's just been a real difficult start for him. Once a couple of chances start falling into the back of the net, then I think we'll start to see the best of Eddie Nketiah. You've also got to remember he's not starting, so he's reliant on cameos off the bench, because that striker place is well and truly owned by Jean-Philippe Mateta. So yeah, as we've said, really, it's just that confidence thing. Needs a couple of goals, needs a run of starts. A lot of the games he played when he was starting was in that left 10. And if anyone's ever watched a game of Eddie Nketiah, you know he's not a left 10. You know he's a number 9. And at 25 years of age, £30 million, a lot of money, a lot of expectation. He's kind of in that middle gap between not a young player anymore, but not quite an experienced player. And yeah, he's just still got a lot to learn for me. But I'm sure we will see the best of Eddie Nketiah at some point, whether that's now or whether that's in a year or two's time, if he's the starting number nine and Jean-Philippe Mertesse's no longer at the club.
You'd have to think that Mateta being an established number one and Ismaïla Sarr starting to pick up in form takes a bit of pressure off him, and hopefully that goal will give him the confidence he needs. Now, before I look at lastly, really about the actual Premier League game as a whole, I want to talk about two players that have garnered much attention on socials as well. I think Daichi Kamada, we know where the faults lie. I think we've talked about that plenty on the pod. I think fans definitely have plenty to say on Daichi. But let's talk about his game in, well, not just his game in the Cup, but his game in the League Two, where perhaps he didn't do much or enough, but certainly didn't look unassured on the ball. I mean, how did you feel about his performance? And again, similar vein, really, but what more do you think he needs to do, and where does he need to develop most to get more out of him?
I mean, I'm really fed up with talking about Daichi Kamada, to be honest with you. I think it's unnecessary. I actually think unnecessary is the perfect word to sum up the conversations around Daichi Kamada. I think there's a motivation behind some of the criticism he gets. I think he's very much become the scapegoat. I mean, he's not started in four Premier League games. Yes, he was suspended, but he's not started in four games. So you give him the benefit of the doubt on some things. I don't think by any means he was the worst player on the pitch in the Premier League game. I think when he come on against Brighton, he did very well. I think when he come on in the Cup, he didn't disgrace himself. There were far bigger issues with Palace's performance in the league. Yeah, it was Daichi Kamada's substitution. It was being celebrated coming off the pitch. There were chants from people in the main stand, like I posted on Twitter. And by no means he had a brilliant game. By no means he even had a good game. But he's a Crystal Palace player. The fans should back him. And yeah, I just think it was a bit unnecessary because there were far bigger issues with that performance than Daichi Kamada.
Definitely. And I think the biggest thing that grinds my gears about his criticism is his wages. It's well documented he's on 100 grand a week. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's not
So
the point.
this was something I was talking about with someone in the press box after the game on Saturday. We were both a bit baffled as to why Daichi Kamada was receiving so much flack on social media. And the celebrations from the crowd because we didn't think he was that awful. We didn't think he was good, but we didn't think he was bad enough to justify that. And the one thing we both came to at the end of that conversation was it's because everyone knows what he's getting paid. Everyone knows the highest paid player in the club. And with that, with the expectation he comes to the club with being a Europa League winner, with everything everyone's seen from him coming from the club, with the fact that he's a Glasner style player, he's played his best football in that left hand role. He come with a lot of expectation and he's not lived up to that. And so it gives people the right to be frustrated. It gives people the right to be like, oh, come on, Daichi, give us a bit more. We expect good things from you. But yeah, I find it difficult to get my head around, really. I think a football fan should always back their players. Even when they're going through a rough patch. And I don't see that with Daichi Kamada. I just see a lot of anger towards him. And as the word I used already, I just see it being unnecessary. And also, the one thing about Daichi Kamada, which I will say about where he can improve, I think sometimes, I don't know if I'd said this on a previous episode, I know I'd spoken to Bruno about it, but I think sometimes he just tries too hard. I think he really wants to prove himself. Like if you look at the way he celebrated the goal, was it Villa he scored? And you just saw the relief on his shoulders, like, oh wow, I can breathe. Because I just think he's really trying to prove himself to Palace fans. And he's just having a rough ride adjusting to English football. Now, that's no excuse for a professional footballer. But I would like people to see people get off his back a little bit.
I mean, if you do some quick maths on 100k a week, that's what, 5.2 a year? So 10.4 overall wage cost across 2 seasons, no fee involved. You know, in book terms, that's not a huge amount compared to the outlays we typically spend on players, including some this summer. That does not mean that the, you know, cost of a player should justify proportionately the criticism they receive. That's not what I'm saying here. Don't misconstrue that point. I'm just saying this isn't as, you know, 100k a week sounds a lot in football terms, right? But it's not the, you know, strategically disruptive figure of, you know, the sort of money that's being bandied around by much bigger clubs. And this isn't actually, in the grand scheme of things, a big problem. It's depth we need, it's creativity we need, and he's getting better, giving away the ball less. His retention's good, his movement's good, there's intelligence there. He's just not really getting off any end product or as many killer passes as perhaps someone of his quality should. But I think, as you say, it's just unnecessary. We go round and round in circles as a fan base with this discourse, just getting on his back all the time. And I think what we need for Eddie and for Kamada is to just put our arm around them and just say, look, We know you're having issues, right? But we still love you. We still think you've got ability here. Let's not get on their back. Let's certainly not cheer them off when they get taken off. You know, it's so unnecessary.
While I'm not saying that Daichi Kamada should be exempt from criticism, because he shouldn't, every player should be open to criticism, I just think it's the manner that criticism's coming across. And I think he probably deserves a little bit more support from the Palace fans. Now, I had a couple of comments on Twitter when I said that about why does he deserve it? He's not shown anything in a Palace shirt. Ultimately, if you want players to show things in a Palace shirt, you need to back them. And I think you raise a really good point with Eze about putting your arm around him rather than getting on his back, because what we've seen from Eze is he plays his best football when he feels comfortable, when he feels loved, when a manager puts his arm around him. If you look at him under Patrick Vieira, Patrick Vieira tried the harsh approach on him. They tried to be brutal with their criticism to him, and it didn't work. They didn't get a tune out of him towards the end of his spell. He ended up having to be put on the bench because it was that bad. You have to get your man management right. And I think from what I can gather, both Eze and Daichi Kamada are players who need a bit of loving to play their best football.
I think Glasnevin understands leadership to an almost academic level. He's incredibly articulate. He did that talk, I think it was at King's College London as well.
It was King's, but also your manager can have that brilliant man management, if you like. But ultimately, if they know they're going to come out to fans getting frustrated with them, berating them, their performances still aren't going to reach their peak level.
Yeah, we have a role to play as fans, ultimately, and I think you make a good point there. So now that we've talked about a few of those players, I was going to raise Eze in more detail anyway, but I think you picked that up. So, you know, I think we can park that one and see what happens with Eze. But looking at the league game in isolation, obviously a battering at home in front of the fans is something that is quite hard to take, but it didn't quite feel like it was a 5-1 performance, was it?
Well, Palace did a lot well. Going forwards, they did a lot well. Mateta should have scored to make it 2-2. Sarr had chances from headers. So Palace did do bits and pieces well, especially going forwards. But their big issue was defending their own penalty area. Now, that's one of the most important parts of a game of football. And if you struggle to defend your own penalty area, then it's no shock if you ship 5 goals. But I think the biggest surprise of all actually comes in the shape of Palace's defence being the problem. Because all season long, Oliver Glasner has been able to rely upon that back line, even when things haven't been going smoothly. So for Palace to put on such a hopeless defensive display was quite astonishing. Now, when I think wider about the issue and try to diagnose what the real problem is, I don't think it helped unsettling the back three. Now, Chalobah, Lacroix, Gay were the established centre-halves. They played 12 games together. They got 12 games in a row together. They had a good partnership, grasp each other's strengths and weaknesses. So for Glasner to unsettle that, take Chalobah out and put Richards in, who's only played 10 minutes since September, just didn't really make sense for me. And I thought Richards had a really poor game. And I just think all of those kind of combined to a pretty chiasmic defensive display.
I mean, I mentioned my flatmate earlier, so shout out Sol if you listen to this. He's quite a level-headed Arsenal fan, which he takes pride in and should take pride in. The first thing I said to him was about that right side, Clyne and Richards, an unfamiliar pairing on that side of the pitch and one that probably hasn't had much minutes between them. He also mentioned Daichi Kamada. We've obviously talked about that, so I won't raise him again. But that whole right side definitely was freshened up. I'm going to assume for rotational purposes, particularly with Richards in for Chalobah. Do you think there was an issue of match sharpness there and being up to speed mentally as well as physically for both players?
When I asked Glasner after the game, why did you change it? Not in those terms. I asked it better than that to try and get a decent answer. And he just said that it was to do with Chalobah playing 3 games in 6 days, 7 days, whatever it was. And that Richards had been doing well in training, so it was time to give Richards a chance. Now, I don't really like that, and I think that answer, it was quite curt, the way he delivered it. So I think it was probably more a tactical decision. Chalobah made a couple of mistakes here and there, and I think it was more just, oh, we'll freshen it up, see what happens, give a new player a chance in defence, because Chalobah's shown a few signs of not playing too well at times. But I also think in recent weeks we've seen Chalobah at his best. Not at his best top level, but he's best in the Palace shirt, certainly what we've seen so far. So I just don't really get the decision to drop him. I think even if it was because he played 7 games in 3 days, I think he probably should have played, because you don't want to disturb that back three. It had been Palace haven't had any issues in defence this season, really. It's been at the front end of the pitch. So to change that, I just, yeah, it, I think it was quite a nonsensical decision, to be fair. I still don't understand it, and I think it contributed a lot to Palace conceding 5 goals.
Definitely. I mean, looking at the XG, I know this is going to make the sort of people who don't understand XG roll their eyes, but Palace created 1.77 XG to Arsenal's 2.62. Now, obviously, we come out second best in terms of overall chance creation and concession as well. But at the end of the day, it's the mark of a clinical and world-class team that you outperform XG in the way that you do persistently. I don't think that's always been the case for Arsenal this season, and this isn't an Arsenal pod, but the 5 goals is testament to quality and our own inability to defend. And, both teams have the exact same number of shots on target with 6. There's an issue of being clinical here. And I have to say, speaking of, let's just look at one positive, that goal from Osmaia Sarr. I mean, to curl it in the way he did was phenomenal. Just talk a bit about that goal, how it came about, what you really liked about it.
Yeah, I think Sarr's been fantastic, actually. I've been really impressed with him in the last few weeks. He's proper come into his own. He looks confident. And when you get as confident as Meyle Sarr, as Ben Foster said when he first joined Crystal Palace, you will get a really good footballer because he's all about confidence. He's got bags of ability. He just needs that confidence. And now he's starting every week and he's high flying, really. He's scoring goals for fun. He's a real threat in behind. I think Palace play their best football really against the bigger teams when they play that high line. And you get Ismaila Sarr with his pacey runs, winning balls from Mateta, setting Mateta up. And yeah, and just exploiting teams in behind. I think that goal was probably different to the goals he'd scored in a Palace shirt so far, but it was full of quality. He played that nice little pass to Mitchell. Mitchell, a couple of touches down the line, straight into the channel. And then, I mean, it was all about Ismaila Sarr, really. Carried the ball brilliantly, got into the box and just produced a top-class curling finish and very impressive. And I think it's probably testament to how good he's been in the Palace shirt over the last 3 or 4 weeks.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, watching on TV, myself and my youngest brother both thought it was a goal the moment he had the amount of time that he did. We could see the game almost slowed down when he made that run into the box and he had so much time just to slot it. I mean, I have to say, Arsenal were all over the floor. I think Gabriel had a stinker, certainly in that first half. I mean,
Arsenal were all over the shop a couple of times defensively, and Palace just didn't take advantage of it. They could easily have made it 2-2 when Sarr set Mateta up, and Mateta was 1-on-1 with Raya, and he failed to finish, which was a surprise for a player of his quality. I think was it in the second half, 3-1, Sarr had a couple of decent chances, both headers. So Palace had their chances to get into the game and make it a more respectable scoreline. But ultimately, it comes back to the thing that they didn't take their chances, and then the defence were awful.
definitely. I mean, just a bit from Sky, just off the top of my head, I remember seeing that they were analysing it in our last 8 games before that. We were first in the league for pressures and offensive pressures inside the box. I believe that's correct. So please correct me if I'm
Yeah,
wrong.
Glasner always talks about how important the high intensity runs have been. Every game they've been practically top in the league for high intensity runs, so that wouldn't surprise me about pressures in the box.
No, definitely. I think our pressing and offensive play has improved remarkably in this run of form. And up until that game, it felt like our defence was also a lot more settled. So with Munoz back and with a bit more solidity in the team again, I feel like we've got an amazing run of games coming up. We've got the likes of West Ham, Southampton, Bournemouth, Leicester, Brentford in there. These are games where if we can play as well as we have been and convert those draws and losses we had at the start of the season into wins, suddenly we can look safe again. I think there's a real opportunity to do so.
I don't think there's any danger, famous last words. I don't think there's any danger of Palace going down. I think there's at least three worse teams in the league than Palace. I just think they're probably underperforming and they should be in a better position than they are. I think you're right. They need to turn some of those draws from earlier the season into wins. I think they can do that, especially with a couple of additions in January. Forgot where I'm going with this.
Oh, we can cut it from there. It's fine. I can jump in.
In January. So yeah, as you say, it's just about turning those draws into win, but no danger of really going down. I think it will be a pretty comfortable second half of the season. It's more just frustration than anything that what could have been if you added a couple more players.
Definitely. I mean, we always seem to. My birthday's in April, and I feel like that's always every season when Palace decide to remember how to play football again. It's like it just hits mid-April, and suddenly we turn into prime Barcelona. I know we did it last season, but it's definitely not the first. We've had good form under Roy Hodgson late in the season too. So I don't know what it is. The sun comes back, and so do we. Bobby, anything to add? No, definitely. Before we wrap up, I think we would be remiss not to talk about Arsenal's goals. We talked about some of the horrible defending in the box, and we talked earlier about Charity FC coming through for Gabriel Jesus. You know, I'm sure you've all seen the classic. Mark Gay loves Jesus so much he let him put five past him in two games. But in all seriousness, I know I've just done a Frank Lampard there, but we need to talk about the goals. It's got to be done. Seriously, Bobby. No, but seriously, mate. Talk to me about those two goals. Average
Yeah,
goal, big goal, or
four fluky goals. So first, I think all of the goals had a real theme to them. It was just appalling Palace defending, really. I don't think any one of the goals were solely Arsenal class. I mean, there were some really good goals in there from Arsenal, especially that Declan Rice one at the end. But yeah, there were just mistakes littered all over from Palace. The first one where Jesus rifled it into the bottom corner was just Palace being disorganised from a set piece, as simple as that. I don't quite understand why Tyrick Mitchell was at right back, Chris Richards at left back. I don't really know why that was the setup. I think maybe because the Arsenal pack were on the left, so to try and deal with the threat of Saliba and Gabriel, that maybe it was better to have Chris Richards that side rather than a slightly shorter Tyrick Mitchell. But Palace didn't get enough pressure on the ball from the set piece. Arsenal didn't. It was just too easy. Arsenal were able to move the ball too easy. It was just disorganized defense, and it was really easy for Jesus to score. The second one again, from the corner come in. Palace don't really do the best job clearing it. It falls to Jesus, who puts one in the top corner. Once again, nowhere near enough pressure on the ball. It's all too simple. It's all too easy for Arsenal. Oliver Glasner said before the cup game that across both games, Palace must not give Arsenal set pieces. Well, on Saturday, they paid the price for giving Arsenal them. The third goal, I mean, Palace were like statues. It was ball watching. It was a lack of effort, horrendous defending. You had the initial shot that hit the post and it bounced out for Havertz to finish again. Nobody moved. Nobody reacted. I'm not saying if people necessarily reacted to the shot hit in the post that Arsenal wouldn't have scored, but you just saw straight away there's a lack of effort. It was almost like, oh, the first one's going to go in anyway, so we won't react, we won't remove. Henderson was rooted to the spot. Really, really poor. And then the fourth and the fifth goal, I mean, it just really summed up what an awful afternoon it was. The fourth goal, Palace were all over the place. Long shot from Declan Rice hits Martinelli and goes in. I don't know what Lacroix was doing. I don't know what any of them were doing, really. It was just appalling defending, a lack of control from Palace, that they overcommitted in attack and paid the price in defence. And the fifth goal, I mean, this one's testament to Arsenal because Jesus, and I think it's really summed up what he did well across all the games, which it wasn't just his finishing ability, but it was his brilliant pressure all game long, that press, that non-stop. Late on in the game, he's running towards the corner flag, pressuring Palace, winning the ball, getting the ball to Declan Rice on the edge of the box, who just curls one into the bottom corner. Once again, it's a lack of Palace pressure on the ball. All the goals had that real similar theme, but it was just that goal was a brilliant Arsenal goal, and it's probably what they did best in the game.
Definitely. I mean, it was a pretty much a disaster class in defending for every single goal for all sorts of different reasons. And I think there's plenty of lessons to be learned here. They'll be taken forward. And speaking of looking forward, you know, my take has been, and I've been saying to friends and family, I wouldn't be surprised if we lost at Bournemouth. I mean, as we record, they've just beat Man United on their own best patch. They're a tough team to beat. But certainly you look beatable at times, and I don't think we should rule out anything positive. We've then got Southampton and then a really good run of games with excluding Chelsea in there. So just we're not a preview pod really, but Bobby, just looking at the run of games we've got, you know, is there going to be an issue, do you think, with the squad lifting their heads up, or do you think that Oliver Glasner will do a good job to re-energize, to get over the blip and to look ahead from here?
I think if you can sort out from the gigantic issues we saw at the start of the season to get to a point where you get one loss in nine, obviously it's 2-10 now, but before, or no, it'd be 3-11, won't it, because of both Arsenal games, but before that, it looked really good for Palace. So yeah, I don't think a couple of bad results will cause too many problems. I think Bournemouth is one of the games you look at as maybe drawable. Glasner goes into every game to win, but I just think they have a little bit too much quality for Palace. I think most fans will probably settle for a point. I think that Southampton game's must win. Poor side Southampton, but obviously new manager in Ivan Juric. He's done really well everywhere he's been, other than Roma. I think it was Torino where he had a really good defensive record. So it's a bit of an unknown about what he'll actually bring to that Saints side. Chelsea's a free hit, and then you're looking Stockport, Leicester, West Ham, and Brentford, and you'd like to think Palace will go unbeaten in those four. Stranger things happen. Football's a funny old game. But yeah, things do look up for Palace at the moment. I follow that even after a couple of dodgy games against Arsenal. But you got to remember, it was just what, 7 days ago when we're recording today that Palace emphatically beat Brighton. There's a good side in that Palace team. They can play really good football on their day, and it's just about getting the right players in January. I mean, as far as I understand, they want to bring in an attacker, maybe two attackers if people are very lucky. But that is being very lucky. They want to bring in a left wing back to provide cover to Tyrick Mitchell, and more importantly, competition to Tyrick Mitchell. And I've seen some people discuss the possibility of a central midfield player. Now, as of now, I haven't got any names on that front, but I could kind of see why Palace would want to do that, because although they're stacked in midfield, there has been a few injuries in there. Maybe you need another player you can utilise there just in case things get bad again. Obviously, we don't know how long Wharton's going to be out for. Sheik Doucouré has been a shadow of his former self, which you expect for a player who's been out for a year. Jefferson Lerma and Will Hughes have been demanded to play a hell of a lot of games. So you can kind of see why a central midfield player would be nice to have. I don't think it's a necessity, but certainly if the right move comes about, I wouldn't be shocked if Palace tried to do that.
I do question what that means for Justin Devenny, but nonetheless, a very good bit of insight from you, Bobby. So thanks for.
I also think Justin Devenny probably plays his best stuff in that 10 role rather than in the pivot. And this seems a really harsh thing to say, but I don't think Justin Devenny is a long-term Crystal Palace Premier League player.
Actually, I agree with that, you know.
And while I think he has done really, he's actually superseded my expectations of in a Palace shirt when he's came in. So fair play to him, and I've really enjoyed seeing him in a Palace shirt. That goal at Villa was brilliant. I think he's a really good technical player, but I just don't see him being a long-term Palace player. So you can't not make a signing to make room for Justin Devenny, because how long is he actually going to be involved in the senior squad?
Look, Bruno's the expert on this, not me, but apparently we're the Palace pod that's obsessed with young kids. So, you know, I think there's a lot of expertise on that. And from what it's worth, Devenny never looked like the wonder kid that was going to break through and really burst into the team and be the David Ozo type. It's quite surprising that he's been as comfortable as he has been. And don't get me wrong, a great player, great passing
This
range,
is
but
where I disagree.
right.
Because while I don't think Justin Devenny has got the best ceiling of any of the academy players, I think he was the most ready to step up to senior football because he's got a hell of a lot of senior minutes under his belt. I know it's in Northern Ireland and Scotland, but he's played a lot of senior football, as with Danny Imre, really. He's played a lot of senior football, and he showed that at Bromley that he's got that understanding of the game, and it's just about increasing his level. So while these players don't have the highest ceilings, they are the most ready to come into a first team and offer something.
That's true. I can't argue with that. I mean, he's got a few years ahead of him, both physically and in terms of his mental development as a footballer, and that obviously shows. So, you know, the good news is ultimately he's shown that he is ready to step in when required, and that's all we ask for. And he's by no means disgraced himself. And that goal against Villa was a
Yeah,
real
he's
reflection.
not. Yeah, not even by no means disgrace himself. He's been good when he's coming, but
Yeah.
I just don't see him as a, and this does feel really harsh. I just don't see him as a Premier League player long term. But he has been really good, and that's where it kind of contradicts himself. He's been really good, but he's not a Premier League player. But I do think obviously his age plays a part in that. He's 21, so he's on the older side of an academy player. As we said already, played senior football elsewhere. But yeah, I've been really impressed with Justin. It's been nice to see an academy player come in and do a job. And all credit to him. And I think he'll go on to have a really good career at a championship club. But I just don't think he is that going to be a middle echelon Premier League player. I don't get that sense with him.
No, definitely. I mean, the time will tell, but ultimately, we'd love to be proven wrong. We both would. And, you know, we hope so, but obviously, what actually transpires may be different. But
He's a really humble kid as well. If you've listened to any of his interviews,
Oh God, yes.
He seems a really nice guy, and yeah, you want all the world for him to do good. I'm not saying he's a bad footballer. I feel like I'm really trying to prove my point here. As
No, you don't need to, but I get what you're saying. Yeah.
it's all that I'm not trying to ruin him, because I'm not trying to ruin him at all. It's like a backhanded compliment, isn't it? You're going to be a really good professional footballer, just probably not in the Premier League.
Yeah,
And
we've got to be realistic. We can't blow smoke up every player in Britain.
exactly that, and that's the thing. And like I say, I hope he goes on to be a 200 appearance maker in a Palace shirt and break every record going. But I just see him being a just falling short. There we go. That's probably the best way I can put it. Just falling short of the mark to be a Premier League player and established Premier League club.
Well, Man City need a Rodri replacement because they're in free fall and we're lapping it up on the pod, aren't we? So, Justin Devaney, can I interest you in him, my friend? We should take back what we said and just say, look,
I think I'll be out of water if I'm honest.
yeah, Adam Wharton, God, he has crossed my mind. He's either sort of player that City throw the bag at for no reason just because they need to bail themselves out. I don't know.
What
That's
do
a
you
complete
think?
speculation, but.
I think it's only a matter of time until City throw the bag at him. Maybe him being injured is a blessing in disguise, because Palace will get another season out of him.
On a more serious note, I want to pay tribute for both myself and everyone at the Palace Way, and obviously from you, Bobby, as well, to the friends and family of Alfie Atkins. I'm sure loads of you know about Alfie, but for those who don't, he was a Palace through and through lad. He followed us home and away from his hometown in Bognor Regis. Much loved by friends, family, and the Palace community at large, and was very popular with those who knew him at home games, at away games. And obviously, to die as he did at the age of 21 very suddenly is just a travesty. And what I was proud of in the aftermath of that was how the whole community came together. We were able to raise over £7,000 for his family to help with a financial cost, which just before Christmas in particular is much appreciated. And what I can only imagine is an incredibly difficult time for all that knew and loved him. We had a whip round ourselves, but it's just a small part to play. And we owe it all to the Palace community who. Really put their arm around a family in need, and we're immensely proud of fans who did that. We're immensely proud of Alfie. He seemed like a cracking lad. He engaged with our socials frequently, and we think based on the data we've seen, he may have listened to the pod as well. So he has a relationship with us too, and we would be remiss if we didn't pay tribute to him. So long may he rest peacefully, and he epitomised everything right about this club. Bobby, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, it was really, really sad news. What I found really moving was the reception in the 21st minute at Selhurst Park on Saturday against Arsenal. I mean, the whole ground pretty much was on their feet clapping. Really moving, re really, really sad. As I say, not someone I really had a personal relationship with, but was taken aback when I read the news. Just no age at all. So sad. And that win at Brighton, I think many would concur, was for Alfie.
We'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much, Bobby, for coming on. I know I don't host the pod anymore, but Bruno and Pat and everyone else we've had on, including you, Bobby, have done a fantastic job this season. And just for this year, I want to wish everyone a very, very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. All the best to you and your loved ones. And I will probably won't be on the pod until the new year. So also a very happy 2025, Happy New Year for me. Like Bobby said, if you're going to Bournemouth, get drunk and have fun. If you're not going to Bournemouth, get drunk and have fun. I'll close it there. Thank you very much for coming on again, Bobby. If you're not following us on socials already, you can do so on X at the Palace Way and Blue Sky at the Palace Way. Blue Sky. Social as usual. We're also on Instagram at the Palace Way and TikTok at the Palace Way podcast, I believe. Thank you very much again for your support, guys. If you haven't already checked out our website too, we're posting high quality articles and analysis and a whole lot more at thepalaceway.com. We even have our own Wordle, which we're still running. We've called it Joel Wardle in honor of our club captain, which is a pun that we've been milking for far too long, but nonetheless fitting, right? So we really appreciate all the support you've given us. If you're not following Bobby already as well, Bobby, what's your out on Twitter? Bobby Manzi Giorno.
No, we're more professional than that these days.
Ah, I'm a fake
We
friend.
are at Bobby Manzi.
Just at Bobby Manzi. Smooth at. Right. I'll leave it there this time for real. Have a lovely time, everyone. Thank you very much for your support and up the Palace.